You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston, channel HD2, live on that channel and streamed off a link on kpft.org to the web internationally. My name is Ray Hill, and we are beginning a new program on this channel. Every time Texas executes someone, we will be on this channel for a one-hour program, either at 5 o'clock or at 6 o'clock, to talk about that execution in particular and executions generally in the evolution of this process of executions. Texas is the most executing state in the most executing industrial nation in the world. In addition to that, Harris County, if it were a separate state, would be the third most executing state in the nation, following only Texas and Virginia. Our radio station, KPFT, is named K because we're west of the Mississippi, PF for the Pacifica Foundation, T for Texas. The Pacifica Foundation was organized by a group of pacifists in 1949. And has been broadcasting since. We have been broadcasting in Houston since 1970. We are fulfilling our responsibility to cover the issue of executions in this state by coming to you live and in real time on the nights that executions are scheduled. Tonight's execution is scheduled for Mr. Turner. Mr. Turner is scheduled to be executed at 6 o'clock or shortly thereafter tonight, pending the possibility of clemency or a stay. During this program, we will talk about those options and where this case stands. This case has been in the courts for a good many years, and it deals with a homicide that happened. Can't hear the news, okay? So they're giving me instructions because we're fixing to go simultaneously live. I'm on KPFT?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Hello?
We're on the news.
Okay. In newsroom. Yeah, this is Ray. I was just explaining to the listeners on HD2 that KPFT is going to fulfill its obligations as a Pacifica station to the issue of executions. We sit in the most executing state in the most executing industrial nation in the world. And if Harris County were a separate state, it would be the third most executing place on the planet. There's some protests going on both here in Houston and in Austin for the Carlton Turner case. And Carlton Turner has been convicted of killing his parents. Some reports say adopted parents. Other reports dispute that. However, the fact is that his scheduled execution tonight, and there are a couple of appeals going on simultaneously with this schedule, and, of course, an application for clemency should be in process. There's always what they call the last-minute appeals, and it's kind of like playing chicken with the legal department. Okay, but the after the denial, then you go through the process and you reset an execution date. That begins everything over again. So there are issues that are going before the appellate courts, as well as an application for clemency that is in process. Any of those things can come into play between now and the execution hour, which in Texas is 6 p.m. or shortly thereafter.
That the clemency would only be actually a temporary to stop, and that it expires after a certain amount of time. Was that correct in that?
The powers of the governor in clemency are very limited. The governor can give a 30-day stay of execution, which grants more time to look at all issues or any issues remaining. The governor does not have the power of clemency in these instances. The governor has the power of commutation under certain circumstances, but that requires action of the entire parole board in advising the governor, and that has only happened twice.
Right. We're going to keep an eye on what's going on up there at Huntsville. Right now, we're going to move on to other news stories.
And I am back with you, my specialized HD2 audience. Carlton is of mixed heritage. His mother is Native American. His father is black. His father is military personnel, and he was raised in various military bases around the country and the world. The medical records from those military base hospitals indicate that Carlton had a rather traumatic childhood. He was frequently treated for assaults and lots of bruises and lots of broken bones in the process. He had a rough childhood. His parents were never charged with any abuses of the children. And that brings to mind the difference between the state of the law in a military base and the state of the law in free world hospitals. If a child reports to the emergency room in a hospital, regular hospital, the personnel there, if they suspect child abuse or brutality against a child, are required by law to report it to the authorities. Such a requirement does not exist in military hospitals. And so we can't say for certain what happened, but chances are that Carlton's childhood come from an abusive situation in his home. At the age of 19, in 1999, a grand jury indicted Turner for the capital murder of his parents. He shot his parents. He went to the media and said he didn't know anything about it, and then he later testified that he did it in self-defense, and a jury in the jurisdiction where he was tried found him guilty. Do we have that?
Dallas County.
In Dallas County. Found him guilty and sentenced him to death. And since then, it's been quite a roller coaster. In April of 2003, the Supreme Court denied certiorari on a direct appeal. In 2004, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals denied Turner's application for state habeas relief. And the Fifth Circuit in 2007 denied Turner's request for certificate of applicability in a published opinion. So this has been all over the map, and Turner now is has a serious problem. He hails from Dallas, and we have a line on his pastor up there, and so what I would suggest is that a little later on we'll be talking to him. But we have a real resource in the studio. We have Jim Skelton, who is an attorney in practice here in Houston, and Jim provides some wonderful services to other lawyers in Houston. Jim is the guy that keeps up with the status of the law and follows the court opinions, and he trains private practice attorneys on what the state of the law is so they can better defend their defendants. Jim.
Joe.
What's going on with this?
With this particular case?
Yeah.
All the appeals have been denied through the Supreme Court's denied cert on it, and what they're basically going to do, they're going to file subsequent writs of habeas corpus, probably both in the Court of Criminal Appeals as well as the Supreme Court, then, of course, plot at the parole board for clemency. They're doing three things: trying to get the Court of Criminal Appeals to do something, the Supreme Court to do something, the Board of Pardons and Paroles to do something. Those are the last three venues.
There's nothing unusual about this, is there?
No, not at all.
Isn't this kind of like playing chicken at the last minute?
Well, it's all you've got. Exactly. You're exactly right.
And this last minute playing chicken, at this stage of the game, isn't the die already cast?
Pretty much. In fact, the truth of the matter is most people working on the writs, what they're really trying to do is just to buy more time, hoping something will change. That's usually fairly fruitless, though, frankly.
And the is there anything that strikes you about the facts of this particular case?
No, there's nothing. I read both the direct appeal and the writ itself, and the current issues that they've been talking about in death penalty cases are not present. For example, the big issue heretofore has been, especially people have been retarded, and this is apparently not an issue in this case. It was never brought up, at least in the opinions I read.
Even if it were a case, if they didn't bring it up, it's dead at this point.
It's pretty well dead, mainly because it's dead for several reasons. First off, 3 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that we couldn't execute retarded people who violated cruel and unusual punishment. And the problem is they left it up to the states to do several things. Number one, to define what mental retardation means. Number two, they left up to states to get a procedure to go through to decide how they're going to do it. And our legislature has done absolutely nothing.
None of that.
So what happened, and surprisingly enough, our Court of Criminal Appeals has pretty well taken over what the legislature is supposed to have done. They set up a definition. They said they're going to do this temporarily. And basically, the chief judge, our chief judge up there, wrote an opinion, said, we've got to do this so we can continue to kill people. We can't wait for the legislature. That's basically what she said. So we've got to do something. We've got to keep killing people. Basically, is what she said in the opinion. So we're going to do what the legislature should have done. So what they did, they defined what mental retardation was and set up a procedure. And they said they'd wait for the legislature to act. Legislature's done nothing. And so, in fact, about a month ago, a case came out arguing that when the court did this, they violated the separation of powers doctrine of the Constitution. When they said they left it up to the states, they thought the state meant the legislature. But our Court of Criminal Appeals said, well, we're also the state. And so they did exactly what the legislature is supposed to do. And our big problem, especially in cases like this, where you have some evidence of children being abused when they're younger, or you have evidence of somebody being retarded, if you do that, have that issue decided after the jury's heard the egregious facts about a murder case, it guarantees they're going to kill somebody.
Well, even if you had a current case, if you didn't raise the issue of mental retardation until, say, the sentencing thing, that's already too late, isn't it?
They've been pretty liberal about applying it retroactive. They've been doing writs on that. And the fact that it wasn't raised at the trial level, you can still do it on the appellate level.
Well, it's basically not gross as the Penry case.
Pardon me?
The Penry case.
Penry was different. Penry was one of those anomalies you talk about. They say that some people are so brutally abused or not death worthy, whatever that's supposed to mean. And so in the Penry case, they said this should be given evidence to a jury that would mitigate, showing because he lived a horrible life, and Penry was terribly abused, that juries should take this in consideration and not execute him because he wasn't death worthy, because he basically had no control over his childhood. That's basically
isn't that also the case in the Henry Lee Lucas case, that the governor wound up commuting his
sentence?
Yes.
Same thing.
Same situation.
Basically same thing.
So in capital practice, it is not unusual to have people that have been really mortally brutalized.
Right. In fact, it's more typical. I'll give you an example. Will Gray, when Will was alive, I helped Will a great deal in some death penalty cases, and I went to death row.
One of my great heroes.
Yeah, he'd been up there about, I guess it was about 10 or 15 years ago. And what amazed me, virtually about it, when we went up there, probably I would estimate that over one-third of all the kids up there had been raised in our reform schools, and they had been pretty well brutalized. That was back when they believed you should beat up kids pretty much. And basically, it looked to me like kind of like a farm. You raise kids and beat them up so you can turn them loose and later execute them. Because over a third of the kids up there had been raised in our reform schools, and virtually every one of them, a guy by the name of Bass that I spent a lot of time talking to.
Yes, famous case.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time talking to him, and he told me how he was treated when he was in reform school, how he was beaten so much. He gets out, and he said he ended up killing a policeman who he killed. And the reason he did it, he said every time he met a cop, he got beat up, and he wasn't taking it anymore. And he killed a cop. And so they pretty well raised him. And most of your, in fact, it's unusual in death penalty cases that the child has not come from a traumatic background. That's really unusual.
Yeah, it looks like there'd be an affirmative defense, in especially capital cases, that would give somebody something to argue if the victim in the case is somebody that deserved killing.
That's the old Percy Foreman argument. Remember the old story years ago in Texas? You get more time for stealing a horse and for murder. The reason was a lot of folks needed killing. There was a horse that needed stealing. That's the old Texas theory.
We're making light of a very serious matter. In Texas, execution is pretty much a machine, isn't it?
Yes. See, the problem, here's the problem with all the mitigation stuff. The problem is, by the time the jury gets to hear that, and this is what makes it difficult, they have heard so many horrible facts. Truthfully, a lot of these capital murder cases are bad. For example, this case currently we're talking about today involved a young man, regardless how he was reared, that killed both his mother and father, then goes out on a shopping spree with their credit cards after he kills them and stuffs them in a closet or garage somewhere and goes out.
Leaves them for a while.
Right. Leaves them for a while and goes, does a spending of money. Then he tells different stories when he talks to the media, then tells a different story at trial. And with his background, with all the record of trouble he got into, those are facts that by the time they get to the mitigating part, the jury's furious with him at that point, and they don't really care if he's done something like that. That's been the real problem with a lot of this mitigating stuff. It comes after they hear the real egregious facts about these murder cases.
And we've got a defendant here that is would either be considered black or racially mixed.
Right. 19-year-old kid.
19-year-old kid. And we have an all-white jury.
Exactly. Because remember, this was tried in Dallas County, and everybody's known about Dallas County. In fact, the truth of the matter is we all know this. Nobody will admit it at the courthouse. They may disguise it with calling Coloradans or Canadians, but everybody knows they're going to strike African-Americans off of juries. Everybody knows that. They've been doing that in Dallas for years.
And they do it here in Houston.
Of course they do it here in Houston.
But is that an issue that is in play at this stage of this man's execution?
There never was a Batson issue. It's called a Batson issue. There never was an issue. And by the way, I'm thinking about that. The federal court, the Sixth Circuit last week, granted a Batson challenge and they struck all white people.
Mm-hmm.
And they say it applies to race and gender. So if you strike all white people, that's also.
And if you strike all women, or all men,
yeah. Same way. But that's not been an issue in this case. At least it's not been raised in any of the direct appeals.
Can you tell from the appellate briefs or opinions that you've read the quality of this man's representation? I mean, it seemed to me shocking that the jury only spent less than 2 hours to find him guilty and less than 2 hours to execute him.
The appeal itself was real plain vanilla. I hesitate to say that it was good or bad because as Darryl Royal once said, you dance with who brung you.
Yeah,
and I don't know what facts were developed. Let me tell you what the new trend is, and no one knows this at this point in this case. The new trend on lawyers is not what they did in trial, but what they didn't do. This is the new trend on ineffective assistance of counsel because about 3 years ago, the Supreme Court reversed a couple of capital murder cases, not because lawyers made mistakes during trial, as they didn't prepare well and didn't call witnesses. And I told our classes back then, I said, the new emphasis is going to go on the fact that they just didn't do enough work pre-trial. We just have to, in fact, our first court of appeals is kind of a redneck court here in Texas. This past week, reversed a case for a lawyer being ineffective at punishment, not calling punishment witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So here you can't tell from the opinion what could have been presented that was not presented. You don't know that. And that's been the new emphasis, especially in death penalty cases.
Well, if the Batson issue, I mean, we've got a fact situation that this guy had an all-white jury in Dallas County at a time when Dallas County was famous for having a memo for striking whatever you call black people Canadians.
Until L. Miller came out, it still was a memo. It may still be.
Until they got the new DA.
Yeah, right.
That was pretty much the operating temperature. Is it too late for that issue to be raised?
Yes, that if I never know it being retroactive. Because, see, here's what you got to do with Batson, and this is why I think it'd be too late to raise it. In the Batson issue, you've got to show the racial mix-up of the veneer, which means that you have to be able to demonstrate that you had say a group
in
of 100
Dallas.
In Dallas.
Yeah.
You got to show that when they called the jury, when you selected them, that certain percent were African American or Mexican American, whatever. You can't go back and recreate that, because when you go back and look at a cold record, they don't put the ethnic background on the jury information sheets. So it'd be impossible to recreate that, because there's no way to know what the panel was initially. Because what you've got to demonstrate, and if that's an issue to raise it, you got to show the racial mix-up of the jury panel. How many were African Americans, and what strikes were used by the state on African Americans? And we don't know that, because all you have in a jury information card's name and addresses and information. You do not have their ethnic backgrounds, nor do you know who was struck, whether they're ethnic or not. You don't know that. It'd be impossible to recreate that at this late date. Couldn't be done that I know of.
And it's a pretty sad situation to people on death row. I remember Winston Cochran talking about one of his clients, who Winston went to see just before they were executing, and he had saved part of his last meal to eat when he got back.
You know, there was a case in Florida where a guy was doing something, going to execute him. He wanted to save some stuff. He didn't realize what death meant. He was just retarded, and so it was sad. It's really sad.
And asking their lawyers, well, what do I do after I die?
Exactly.
Right. That kind of lostness. Yet we proceed in this society, in Houston, Texas.
Ray, what we're really doing in a lot of these cases, and there's no question, the best argument, I think, against capital punishment, you can't argue the facts, because when you get down to arguing the facts, you're so egregious that oftentimes anybody would be offended by what the person does. The guy, there's a writer that used to be a U.S. attorney in Illinois, was a part of that commission that went to work for Illinois before the governor commuted all the death sentences to life.
Mm-hmm.
And he went into this. He was the head of the commission that made a study believing in the death penalty. And when he concluded his work, he decided against the death penalty. And here's why he said. He said, it's not the fact that people haven't done horrible acts where they forfeit the right to walk among us.
Sure.
He said, what's happened, we just can't do it right. Is that, for example, men are more likely to be executed than women. For
mm-hmm.
example, if Andrea Yates had been named Andy Yates, he'd be dead now.
Absolutely.
There never would have been a question about
right.
that.
No question.
And so, but because women are treated differently than men are for the same crime, so if some man had drowned his five kids, there would never have been an outcry for him like there was for, I'm not saying it's wrong for Villa Webb, but Andrea Yates.
Sure.
Other areas are more prone to give the death penalty than others. It tends to be, and a lot of people who are poor and ignorant get it more than people who are richer and smarter. And he just simply said, it's not that we shouldn't have the death penalty, we just can't do it right as society. And that makes sense to me.
And the fact that there's such a broad range of competence in defense lawyers.
Exactly.
I mean, what kind of roulette is that?
Well, let's give an example. We had this last case everybody got an uproar about when the guy got the life sentence for killing the policeman.
Yeah.
The lawyer that handled that case did something that a lawyer named Bob Tarrant did years and years and years ago that I thought was a real clever, good idea. But it had been tried. And I thought when she first did it, I thought of Bob Tarrant. Years ago, what had happened? There was a couple of kids that had multiple sclerosis, and I think they were brothers. And one of them was about 13, one of them was about 9. And they were down at Clear Lake fishing in their little wheelchairs. And
sure. And
this guy, Bob's client, just kind of wigged out and pushed both of them off in the lake and drowned one. And for no apparent reason, he didn't know him. And pushing a kid off in a wheelchair in a lake and drowning one and almost killing the other one is not the sort of thing you can usually take to a jury and make any headway. So what Bob did, he claimed insanity, not because he thought his client was insane, but this provided him an avenue at guilt innocence to mitigate what he had done rather than waiting for the punishment hearing.
Okay.
Because see, what happened at guilt innocence, all this evidence came in about his traumatic childhood to support the insanity plea. This came in contemporaneous with the horrible acts that were committed, which offset and kind of didn't justify what he did, but explained what he did. And he used the insanity defense as a means, as a vehicle.
To get through to the jury.
Yeah, but that was at guilt innocence.
Yeah.
That's what's critical. Because see, now the way it's done, when you get to that part of it, You've already heard all the bad stuff. Mm-hmm. And by then, your mind's turned against you. And so what she did much what Bob Tarrant did. She claimed insanity at the guilt-innocence stage, and this provided a vehicle to get in mitigating evidence about his background in childhood at the guilt-innocence part, so when they heard the bad stuff, they heard some stuff to kind of explain why it was bad.
Jim, I'm going to interrupt our conversation. We may return to it, so keep it place. And I've got Dr. Frederick Haynes on the air. Dr. Frederick?
Hello, how you doing, Ray?
I am well, sir. I'm concerned about Mr. Turner. Can you shed some light on this case from the perspective? Dr. Frederick Haynes is a senior pastor at the Friendship West Baptist Church in Dallas, and he's been concerned about these issues in that jurisdiction for some time. Well, does this not bring those issues to home where you are?
I mean, without a doubt, I think we all know that Dallas County leads the nation in the number of prisoners, persons who've been exonerated by DNA evidence through the Innocence Project. We also know that Dallas has a history of cases or instances where African Americans have been excluded from the jury pool. And so the irony of that is, whereas African Americans historically have been refused a seat in the jurors' box, oftentimes African Americans have been on the receiving end of execution in the electric chair. So it's very bothersome. As a minister of the gospel, Martin Luther King Jr. said it so well, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That kind of mentality as it relates to the death penalty will leave us all blind, toothless, and ugly as a society. So this case, of course, is quite bothersome. Even the family members of the victims are opposed to this death sentence tonight. So this is just a very dark time in the state of Texas, and Dr. King is so on target right now. This is very ugly.
Well, Dr. Haynes, I've been talking here with an attorney who says who's looked over the appellate briefs and looked over the decisions in this case, and the Batson issue, which is the racial composition of the jury, has not previously been raised in this case. And so here we are at apparently the second round of a scheduled execution. Is there something wrong in the Dallas area that this man has may not have received the kind of defense that he deserves?
Right. Well, I mean, unfortunately, the documentation of discrimination in Dallas
is legion.
Criminal justice.
It's famous all over the world. I mean, Dallas has been the laughing stock. They even found a memo instructing prosecutors on the importance of removing black jurors. And I mean, and at least in Houston, they engaged in the euphemism of calling them Canadians. But in Dallas, it was pretty straightforward.
Right, just blatant.
Yeah.
And unashamed. And so, again, with this nation, one of the founding principles of this nation and its democracy is the right to a fair and just trial. And it's evident that in Dallas County, that kind of process has been circumvented. Injustice has been the norm, especially as it relates to poor people and African Americans. And the system is broken. And for us to go through with this execution tonight, in light of the system being broken, in light of the history, says that not only are we ugly, but crazy, because if you do what you've done and expect something different, that's the definition of insanity. So this is a very dark time, and I hurt for the family. I hurt for the victims' family members who, again, are adamantly opposed to this.
Dr. Haynes, I have to point out that things in Dallas have improved as a result of recent elections up there.
Correct.
You've got a different district attorney who seems to be genuinely concerned at pursuing innocence, and that must be like a breath of fresh air politically.
But not only is it a breath of fresh air, it's just continuing that metaphor, recreated the climate here in the county. Now, there are forces of the past that are without question trying to make this a difficult transition for District Attorney Watkins. But the good news is he has a strong determination that justice is served in Dallas County. And so we believe that though we still have a long way to go, we're a lot better off now than we were before he was elected.
And what is the number of exonerations in Dallas County? It's been 17, hasn't it?
Now it's up to 19.
19 people are exonerated by DNA.
A young man came to my church 2 weeks ago who was recently released after 27 years. Imagine that, losing 27 years of your life for a crime you did not commit. And the beautiful thing is that this African-American brother has no resentment whatsoever towards the system. He's just determined that the system be corrected, that it be fixed. But again, I can't imagine, I'm 47, and I can't imagine losing 27 years of my life for something I did not do.
Well, he may be made of better stuff than me too,
yes.
Pastor, because I don't know if I would look at it that generously. Are you in the church doing tonight?
Well, tonight there are several of us in our prayer ministry who will be gathering in prayer for Mr. Turner, but also for this system. And so we will be in prayer. As a matter of fact, we started our prayer for him this past Monday, and tonight there are those of us who are gathering in prayer in a candlelight vigil for him.
And as you are praying, there are probably a couple of teams of lawyers working with the court system trying to save this man's life, to take another look at the facts and the processes of this trial.
Right.
I wish your prayers success.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us on this, the first of a series of special programs at this radio station, KPFT.
Thank you so much for helping to change this climate of injustice.
Well, on this channel, KPFT HD2, every time there's an execution in Texas, we will be here.
And hopefully we won't have to do it too many more times.
I think we're getting to the point where at least there is some consideration of ending this continuing tragedy that has gone on all of my lifetime.
Wow.
Thank you very much, Dr. Haynes.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Frederick Haynes from Friendship West Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas. I'm sure they have a website. Look it up and give them some regards. And now I'm going to go back to Jim Skelton. What's happening that you can't see from where you're sitting is we're in contact with the Texas Defense Network. I'm trying to find out if there's any action in the courts, if we hear word of a stay or a commutation. We'll certainly bring that to you in real time. If none of that evolves, apparently Texas Death Machine will crank up at 6 o'clock. And shortly before that, Mr. Turner will be strapped into a gurney and needles applied to his arms. And they will await the 6 o'clock hour. Last-minute checks with Austin and the courts will be made via telephone. And if the warden hears no other information, he will give a signal for the executioners to apply the chemicals. There are three chemicals that were given. One of them presumably will put him to sleep. Another one will presumably cause his muscles to relax and his lungs to collapse, and the third one will stop his heart from beating. And then a physician will come in to ascertain that he is dead. And that is a ritual process. I've likened this, Jim, to if you took a modern-day Houstonian and set him down in an Inca city, 200 years ago, or 300 years ago, and he looked around. He said, "Oh, look at this wonderful architecture! Look at these pyramids, and look at this what they do with numbers. I mean, look at this calendar. It's complete with every eclipse of the moon and the sun for eternity." And then, but what's this business about dragging somebody up the steps of that temple and cutting their still beating heart out and throwing it down and the blood running? What's that about? Well, the Aztecs would say, well, we have to do this because if we didn't, the seasons wouldn't change and the corn wouldn't grow and our society would collapse in chaos.
I have a different view. See, they were killing the virgins because they wouldn't mess around. They didn't care. So, my view is a little bit different.
Well, I mean, if you take that Aztec citizen and you bring him to downtown Houston, yeah, and have him look at all this glass,
right,
and all that, and then he said, well, you know, look at all this wondrous things and all this literature and all this media. I mean, you send a person to a moon and back. Yet, you will schedule a date specific, and you will count down the minutes, and you will record how many times he breaks wind.
Right.
And what he has to eat, what his last words are, and then you reach it. What's that all about?
And you know, the thing that struck me, Ray, and I, when you were talking, and we've never taken this into consideration, our court system. How would you feel if your life was determined by the mistakes you made when you were 19 years old? And most of us, when we look back, we keep forgetting that if my life had been determined by the stupid stuff I did when I was 19 at a later age, I mean, I would have probably been executed too. And one of the things they've never taken into consideration, especially in death penalty cases, is that when you're dealing with a brain that's 19 years old, and usually in many of these instances when kiddos are this young and they've been to this much trouble, unless there's some type of underlying, like you have some people who are born, like maybe a sociopath or something like that, usually it's because of trauma in the childhood. And when you have, and I've discovered this a long time ago, I've met a lot of people who've gone through traumatic backgrounds who snapped out of it.
Sure.
And usually the difference is intellect. If you're bright, you can kind of say to yourself, my stomach, the feelings on my stomach, your head will tell you you shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a little slow and dim-witted, like Charlie Bass is a real good,
sure,
example. He got beat up a great deal when he was a young kid, but he's also not very bright. And when you get a kiddo who's been treated like that and they're fairly young, they got all the raging hormones that kids have when they're 19 and 20, I'd hate for my life to be judged by that sort of conduct I pulled when I was 19. And we've never really done a very good job of handling, at least in the court system, the fact that youthful offenders, like a 19-year-old kid, is judged on the same merit as somebody who's mature, who's come from a regular background. We've not done a very good job with that. But you think about it for a moment. From what you've told me about his background, here's got a 19-year-old kid that, and I've never really trusted career service people anyway. I've always,
yeah,
thought there was kind of a bubble off plum to stay in the service that long. I remember in the K-Mutiny, they used to say the career guy is a second-class job for a second-class person. I think that's probably true. And you take a kiddo who's 19 years old who does this, it's hard to believe that they should deserve to die for this sort of conduct.
Well, you know, what, apparently, unless somebody does something in the next half hour, 20 minutes,
right,
this man is dead. I knew someone that knew Charlie Bass from France.
Oh, you did? Oh, you did?
From France. He had friends in France.
I saw Charlie just before he died. I went up to help on some of his writs, and I don't recall. We didn't talk about that.
Yeah, but his someone from France that came over, mm-hmm, and was on the prison ship.
Was that pretty? I remember that group came over here and did, yeah, that show on you. I remember, yeah, that. Yeah,
and that they duplicated the prison show through a Catholic Church station. But what about the theory? And I don't know if it's valid or not. I don't live at a courthouse that. A lot of this capital punishment business is the chauvinism of prosecutors.
I think it's probably deeper than not so much chauvinism. Let me tell you the problem. A good example of that, a number of years ago in New Orleans, they gave awards out to prosecutors who got the death penalty, and it was used for a competitive thing among the prosecutors who could get the death penalty. It's kind of like a star in their cap. And the problem is, man is a pretty competitive creature, and I was a prosecutor at one time. I remember it well. And I remember going by to see one of my fellow prosecutors one day, and they said he was out celebrating. I said, what's the deal? And they said he got a 60-year sentence. And I thought, you know, I've been in trials where a guy got 60 years, but I never felt like celebrating. It's kind of a sad, and I never felt like it's a,
sure,
good thing to do. But the problem with death penalty case, it becomes a competitive thing. where, you know, you kind of earn your spurs, and the more death penalties you have. We gave a good example. One of our prosecutors, who was one of the leading ones who tried a lot of death penalty cases, was Chuck Rosenthal.
Yeah.
You know the type of mentality that would do
Absolutely.
That. You got a real good example of that, because Chuck tried a whole bunch of death penalty cases, and I would imagine...
Well, Hot Lips was famous for just being... scruples were not important to him, and not to mention the hypocrisy. I mean, he vigorously prosecuted Barno, apparently had a pretty good collection.
Right. And so I'm just simply saying that the problem is it becomes a competitive thing, and it's a way that people get promotions. And it's almost kind of macabre when you think about it, that you earn your spurs the number of people that you've helped execute. I always thought that was a little bit bizarre.
Elizabeth, are you checking to see if there's any word on stays or clemency?
Yes, I did check. I called the Office of Texas Defender Service in Austin, and the attorney for Carlton Turner, Maury Levin, was on the phone, and there was no word so far.
But she has things filed? There's a clemency file. Do you know those things?
She has. I know she has petitions filed with the Supreme Court.
Okay. She's handling the appellate stuff, the clemency stuff, and a recent case that did result in a stay that actually came from the trial court. The last time we were up to bat here, they got a stay from the original trial court instead of the Supreme Court. All of that was pending. But I was shocked to find out that there had been no clemency.
But wasn't that on the trial court? Wasn't that one where the prosecutors messing around with the judge?
Yeah.
I was thinking that one. Because it's going to be something very unusual. There's nothing that I've been able to see in this case that'd be comparable. And I'm not trying to be pessimistic, but there's nothing I've seen that... would take this out of the normal case. It's going to continue on. I just think that I'm not real optimistic of anything being done, at least from reading what I've read in this case. There's no issues that have not been already resolved that I'm aware of, unless, again, there's something like I say, the major emphasis on what was not done as opposed to what the lawyers did do. And, again, I'm not faulting the lawyers. I mean, I've been in death penalty trials on both sides.
What about that? What about the stress on the defense team?
Let me tell you what the defense team, we were talking about this at my last Wednesday meeting. The problem when you're doing a death penalty case is usually at that point, the person that you're defending has burned so many bridges, it's sometimes extremely difficult to get people to come forward. And then when they do come forward, oftentimes they themselves have got records that are not very polished or good people. So you don't nearly have the opportunity of presenting witnesses as sterling as the state has.
Mm-hmm.
That's problem number one. Problem number two is just plain stupidity. I hate to say that, but I remember one, and this, I'm not making this up. Robert Pelt and I defended a kid once on the death penalty case who didn't understand what death meant. And I talked to his mother, didn't understand. I said, look, they want to kill your kid. What does that mean? I said, well, they want to kill him. Well, what about his speeding? He talked about his speeding tickets. I said, lady, don't worry, they're wanting to kill him. And so they offered us a life sentence, and we were going to take him. The reason being, he'd robbed two stores in a row, killed a guy, and everybody at the store knew him. He robbed his neighborhood store.
Sure.
It wasn't a stranger. So there's no. And I knew the moment they said guilty of Captain Murder, he's going to get a life sentence anyway. And they offered us a life sentence. We wanted to take it. And I told the prosecutors, here's the problem. He does not understand what we're talking about. So when we were selecting the jury, we were sitting at counsel table with him. And when you select a jury, they bring a juror up and put him in the witness stand like a regular witness.
Sure.
And so when the witness was talking to the prosecutor who questioned first, and he told the witness, the prospective juror said, as sure as you're sitting up there, we're going to ask for the death penalty, and this man over here, and pointed toward my client, he began to look around. And I whispered, they're talking about you. He said, man, that's cold. He couldn't believe it. And so after a couple of days, he realized they were serious, and we worked it out. So you got that one problem. A lot of folks that get in this system, it's not because they're retarded. They just have been lived such a life that they don't know anything about how the system works. Then the next thing you've got, and this has always been a source of contention, you've always got to look over your shoulder for a writ lawyer. Because no trial is going to be perfect, and there's going to be things that you overlook. And you've got two enemies you're fighting, the state who wants to execute your client, and then you have the writ lawyers who want to hang you up by your gonads claiming you did something wrong. So you've really got two adversaries, truthfully.
Well, isn't that probably a refinement of the system? Isn't that kind of the way?
I think it's the corruption of the death penalty. I wouldn't call it refinement.
How much influence do capital trials have on the rest of the law?
None that I know of.
In other words, our rules of evidence, what's admissible, that's not influenced by these capital.
You know what I think happened? I think it does just the opposite. I think most courts will stretch as far as they can to avoid the death penalty. For example, the Supreme Court just recently ruled you can't execute a guy just for a non-murder case, sure, like in child rape.
But boy, that created a stir.
I know that. But I think our courts and judges are a lot more sympathetic and sensible than the legislature. And I think most of them are somewhat sympathetic. They're especially in federal court, they're real good about reversing cases on the district court level. That, for example, remember our famous sleeping case of sure, Joe Cannon, who went to sleep during trial. It took a federal court to reverse that case. In fact, what's so crazy, our Court of Criminal Appeals, in fact, McCormick wrote the opinion. Back then, they were claiming the law was ineffective, and one of the things they were doing, if they can blame it on trial strategy, and believe it or not, McCormick wrote in the opinion he thought the lawyer was sleeping to gain sympathy from the jury as a trial tactic.
Okay.
That's how nutty it got. But our court since, in fact, in that opinion about the death penalty case of not killing people for non-death crimes, like not killing sick people who commit sex crimes, they talked about the trend in this country is moving away from the death penalty. And I think our courts are ahead of the legislature in that, because they've been pretty liberal about that, more so than
I've been to the Texas legislature, and one of the unfortunate things about Texas legislature, one of the things, is that it meets 5 months every 2 years instead of
That's too often.
And the other thing is that they think they're obliged to do stuff.
Right.
And we'd be a lot better off if they didn't have that obligation. They rarely wrestle with these issues, as you pointed out earlier in the discussion.
Exactly.
That after the decision on mental retardation, the legislature made no effort to come up with the parameters.
And it still made no effort.
And Texas, do we have a class of people in this society that are subject to be executed? Is there a group of identifiable people that are going to wind up being executed, and can you identify them before they reach that point?
If there would be a class race, usually, if I had to name a class of people end up on death row, it's normally some kiddo, much with it like this kiddo, somebody who has some sort of mixed ethnic background. That's mm-hmm. Step number one. Step number two, they've normally had a traumatic, horrible childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, they're normally, I'm not saying they're stupid, but I'm saying they're not particularly bright. Like Charlie Bass is a classic example. And I don't know how you fix that. Like Penry's a good example. Penry was so brutalized and abused, but he's also somewhat slow, is a nice little way for it.
And you know, so was that fellow that they commuted his name, Henry Lee Lucas.
Exactly.
I mean, it was a horrible, horrible childhood. But we can identify those people.
Usually they come from, and the sad thing about it, I'm not saying that only poor people beat up their kids. I'm just saying it tends to be more common in neighborhoods like San Leon and Baycliff, or
sure,
what we call trailer park folks,
sure,
you know. In fact, I've often said every lawyer ought to build a shrine around a mobile home. If it wasn't for mobile home in East Texas, lawyers would starve to death. That's
in
right.
In this state.
In this state, they would. And if you had an identifiable class, that would probably be it. And
I remember I was working for Rick Young one time, and the Javier brothers bought one of the guns for Christmas. And Rick said, well, you know, I'll make $100,000 off of them next year.
Well, you take, for example, and this is how callous people get. One of the negative things about the courthouse is that they hear so much stuff, they're desensitized. Remember the Brantley case?
Mm-hmm.
When they said, and John Martin was the judge. And I knew John before he went to law school.
Mm-hmm.
John was at least a pretty decent guy until he got on the bench, and he, thank God he's dead. I mean, like I say, I'm happy that he died.
Yeah, he was been replaced by the prosecutor in that case.
I understand, but what happened, don't forget, remember they set the execution date on the current clerk's birthday to kind of celebrate it?
Yeah.
Remember they did that crazy thing?
Really?
And John Martin was a decent guy back when I knew him, but after he got around the courthouse and got so callous about hearing all this stuff, it became kind of a macabre sort of thing that they thought it was kind of clever to set an execution date on the birthday of the county clerk, the district clerk. It's like a joke to them. And they've heard, and that's where I think where it affects the trial level is that people get pretty callous after a while, and you don't get elected in Texas by being a liberal. The L word used to kill you, and you get elected in Texas wanting to kill folks, and that's how you get elected.
Well, and let me look at the other side. Is there a culture around the courthouse that people not there do not understand?
Yes. I think absolutely true.
And so is, I mean, the people listening to this radio station,
right,
that do not hang around the courthouse and do not deal with execution issues and trial issues and all that, they don't understand what's going on in that culture.
No. Let me give you an example.
Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, let me give you an example. Most people think that prosecutors have a lot of sympathy and empathy for the victim. The truth of the matter is, and most prosecutors talk, they spend most of their time talking about what a no-good SOB the defendant is. The defendant, I mean, the fact that someone's a victim is usually pretty meaningless. They don't care.
Go ahead, Jim.
Let me give you an example. I remember years ago I defended a guy for rape, and he raped a virgin. And they spent more time giggling about the fact she was a virgin and what a no-good SOB he was rather than having any real sympathy for the victim themselves. Exactly. And I think if most people knew how cynical this becomes, they'd be just appalled. Because here's our problem. In Harris County especially, and I can't speak about other counties as much, everybody on the bench, with the exception of about three people, went directly from school to the prosecutor's office, from prosecutor's office to the bench. And really our judiciary's retirement program for deadbeat prosecutors,
sure,
you couldn't get a job anywhere else.
Sure.
Because I promise you, if they fired every judge down there today, no law firm would hire them. I can't think of one that'd be hired by a law firm.
And well, I mean, it's a culture there.
Yes.
It's a culture there. And that culture affects the very life, frequently, and certainly the liberty of people that are represented by the criminal defense law.
Exactly.
Okay, what's the latest word, Elizabeth?
Ray, I just spoke in Huntsville with Jason Clark, who's a spokesman for the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, and he says they're still awaiting word from the Attorney General's office that it's, in his words, okay to go through with it. He says the Attorney General's office handles the appeals process, so they would be the ones who are the most up to date on where the appeal is. There are usually phone calls that go back and forth between the Attorney General's office and the warden throughout the day, so they're just waiting for that final word about whether all the appeals have been exhausted.
Yeah, as I was explaining earlier how the process works, the warden will, in just about 7 minutes, begin the process of waiting for the final word. That will be over the telephone, and it will be in the voice of an assistant attorney general who will tell the warden that, in his opinion, the execution should proceed. I beg the question of letting the one side be in charge of the whole process, because the appellate work, certainly there's a defense lawyer and there's an assistant attorney general working on that, but the warden will only get word from the assistant attorney general as to whether or not the execution is to proceed. They do not see any conflict in that. Seems to me apparent that there's a conflict in that. Jim, the reason I ask questions about the culture at the courthouse is because there are people out there listening to this who, because of just a handful of circumstances, could wind up being charged with a crime. And constitutionally, it is presumed that they are innocent, but that's not really how the system works, is it?
No.
And unless there is some exonerating DNA evidence, as we've had 19 people exonerated in Dallas County and some people exonerated in Harris County. And that's because the lab, Houston Police Lab, did not testify as to what the science found. They testified to what the prosecutors and the cops wanted them to testify to sustain their conviction. And when that proved to be bad science and was corrected, they were exonerated. Your very liberty, and in some cases your life, may depend upon the opinion of you held by a few people.
Let me give you a better example than that. That's been a real current problem that I was unaware of until about a month ago. We've had a, and this is a classic example, a guy gets busted for a drug case, and he gets busted on a weekend. And they don't test the drugs. They just throw him in jail. Well, he can't make a bond because they make the bond enormously higher. So he goes to a jail docket, and they offer him probation. That means he can get out of jail. And even though oftentimes he knows that the drugs they caught him with when that test positive, he does not want to stay in jail. And so there's no lab reports. And they're permitting people to enter pleas of guilty on drug cases without a lab report. Two different times, in fact, twice this month, lawyers have called me up on instances where guys entered pleas at jail dockets because they couldn't make the bond and didn't want to stay in jail and lose their job and pled guilty. One guy had been on probation for several months and had come back. The lab report finally came back and it was negative. It was never drugs to begin with. He spent like $1,000 on probationary fees. God knows what else he'd spent on a case that he never should have pled guilty to.
Yeah, but they don't put the cork back in that bottle.
I realize that. And then we had another guy, another lawyer came to me that had, in fact, she felt real embarrassed about it because she pled a guy out at a jail docket without a lab report. And this guy gets sent to the state jail facility, and the lab report comes back several months later. It's not drugs. And here this guy's been entered a plea of guilty. He's already serving time in jail. And this is one of, and this could happen to anybody. Because, if, for example, if you're running around with pills and they're not in the right prescription bottle, you can be arrested for that.
Sure.
And we have a tremendous number of drug cases, and they're permitting people to plead out at jail docket as soon as they get in jail to avoid making the bond. And one reason is the bond's so high. In fact, I brought this up with Judge Likas today at a hearing. She's running for DA, said they couldn't do something about it. It just seems to me you should never, ever in a drug case, which a lot of people are victims of, let a person plead until you know for certain it's a drug. And if you don't have the lab results back, they should give you a PR bond.
And then there's the famous case in the property room at the police station.
Of course.
Where stuff was tested and it had a high degree of purity. And when it was retested at trial, it had been diluted.
Well,
and
a lot of it wasn't there.
Missing, right.
And some of it wasn't there.
That's the case.
You had some happy cops leaving the property room.
I am Ray Hill, and this is an execution special on KPFT Houston's HD Channel 2. For the last hour, we've been talking about the execution of Clarence, of Mr. Turner, and of Carlton Turner, and Carlton is apparently going to be executed in the next few minutes. And so we are here to tell you what we know about this case and about the execution and the practice of execution in Harris County and in Texas. And so I thank you for joining us. I hope you will share this program or knowledge of this program. And we will be back here either at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock. Either we will be here the hour before or the hour following an execution. KPFT Houston is fulfilling its obligation as a Pacifica station to this issue. I want to thank our crew, which is Elizabeth Stein, who has done the groundwork in preparation for tonight's show. I want to thank Jim Skelton, who has been my guest through most of the program, who share. And Jim is in the studio with another attorney, so she's going to give him a grade after today's appearance. And I want to thank the pastor from Dallas, Dr. Frederick Haynes, for discussing the issues that he and his congregation deal with in the atmosphere of Dallas, where this case came from. And, of course, I want to thank Pacifica Foundation and KPFT for this opportunity. I'm Ray Hill.
Good night.